Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the United Nations, where world heads of state are gathering for what is expected to be a session dominated by the question of Palestinian statehood. Veteran UN correspondent Ian Williams joins us. He covers the UN for Foreign Policy in Focus. Then we'll look into the state of disillusionment amongst progressives when it comes to supporting President Obama's re-election in 2012. Mike Lux, the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies, who was formerly a special assistant to President Clinton for public liaison in the White House, joins us to discuss the possibility of primary challenges and how the president can win back his disaffected base. Then finally, with two theocratic candidates running for president, Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann, we will analyze the results of American theocracy in terms of life in the red states dominated by the religious right. Stephen Schwartz, senior fellow at the Samueli Institute, joins us. He has an article in the science journal Explore, The Rise of American Theocracy, Implications for Science and Healthcare. Joining us now is Ian Williams, who is a veteran journalist who has covered the UN for decades. He is an author as well as a senior analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus. He writes for Salon and Alternet, among others, and is the author of a number of books, including The UN for Beginners and Deserter, George W. Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans and His Past, and Rum, A Social and Sociable History. His blog is Deadline Pundit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Williams.
Good to talk to you, Ian.
And this week at the United Nations, of course, is when the world leaders gather, and clearly this week or the following weeks are going to be dominated by the question of statehood for Palestine. And clearly there's some frantic maneuvering going on to head that off, to head off an inevitable veto by the United States, which would be deeply embarrassing for the United States. Where does that stand at the moment?
It's difficult to tell. It was interesting in President Obama's speech. He didn't actually directly mention any type of threat or veto. He did remind people, he might have maintained a discreet silence, but other people noticed. But, of course, 12 months ago, he got up there and said he looked forward to welcoming a Palestinian state within 12 months, which makes the U.S. embarrassment even more complete, because it is totally irrational. I think a lot of people wonder why the Palestinians started on this. But, obviously, a lot of Palestinians think it was an attempt by the Abbas and the Palestinian Authority to show some signs of progress. But obviously they've touched on some raw nerves, certainly in Israel, and the Kudniks and Netanyahu are pulling the strings on Obama in an unprecedented way. And I think I know the sort of complex of reasons behind it. But one thing is for sure is that this has no direct interest for the United States whatsoever. This veto, or even the threat of a veto, and the brouhaha that's gone on so far, has alienated even further Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, all of the other regional powers. It has sort of removed any, residual enthusiasm that the Arab masses of the Arab Spring might have had for the United States as an honest broker in all of this. And it's profoundly embarrassed the Obama administration because even if people in Europe actually do follow instructions, they're very embarrassed. They realize that they're pulling his irons out of the fire. This is a complete self-inflicted wound for the Obama administration. He could have turned around to Netanyahu and said, hey, you didn't do what we asked you to. Why should we do this for you now?
Well, presumably, with an election year coming up, the president simply doesn't want to pick a fight with Israel and be the subject of an attack by the Israel lobby. The New York Times on Wednesday has a front-page story talking about how Netanyahu's influence is so great in the Congress that the president has to turn to Netanyahu to help him with the Congress.
Well, we saw that when Netanyahu addressed Congress. I mean, it was one of the most disgustingly slavish displays ever. He got more standing ovations than Joseph Stalin on an average speech. It was just unprecedented. And there is this fear of the Israel lobby, which is sort of tacitly trying to claim the credit for the Republican upset in the New York special election last week, which produced Republican Bill Turner to replace Anthony Weiner. But, you know, if you look down in the numbers there, there are far more issues there than Israel behind it. And with a very few exceptions, any president that actually got up and said, look, I don't think we should be giving $5 billion of our hard-earned taxpayers' money to another country that continually cocks the snookers, I think that would be a huge winning program, frankly.
Short of that, which is highly unlikely, at least if the president were to take a pro-Palestinian state stand, you know, you probably noticed, Ian Williams, the recent op-ed in the New York Times by the former Saudi ambassador, former head of intelligence, Prince Turkey, warning the U.S. that it will dissipate what little credibility it has left in the Arab world. I mean, I take it that you explain to me, why are the reasons, apart from the influence of Israel over domestic politics in an election year, what are the other reasons why the U.S. has to take this position? Because, you know, ironically, it's somewhat similar to what the Israelis found themselves in before they were a state back in 1948.
Well, I don't think there's any rational reason for the U.S. apart from doing what Netanyahu wants. And there are many people in Israel who sort of have pointed out, look, Obama says he wants a two-state solution with a Palestinian state. The Quartet has said they want a two-state solution with a Palestinian state. The UN has said that they want a two-state solution. And even Netanyahu has said he wants a Palestinian state. He doesn't really. He wants a Palestinian state like he wants lung cancer. We all know that, but he has to say this for international diplomacy. And so you've got a whole complex of reasons. In Israel and in the U.S., the people who are really deeply opposed to this are people who do not want a Palestinian state, don't accept that the Palestinians have any rights at all within mandatory Palestine in any part of it, and would just assume they all went away. They're just going along for public relations purposes. And, you know, in that context, it's interesting that the people who turned out in who voted against the Democrats in the election here, they might have done it for Israel, but these are included an unhealthily high proportion of people who think that Obama is a Muslim infiltrator without an American birth certificate and similar kooky notions. They're not representative of mainstream American Jewish opinion, let alone American public opinion. And by pandering to Netanyahu, in fact, Obama is sort of is pandering to some of his worst and kookiest enemies on the home front. It makes it even more puzzling why he would do this or why it would be considered a rational thing to do.
Again, I'm speaking with Ian Williams, who is a veteran journalist who has covered the United Nations for decades. He is a senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, and you write for Salon and Alternet, and we're talking about what's happening at the UN this week, dominated as it will be by the question of Palestinian statehood. I recently interviewed David Miller, who served 6 secretaries of state and was President Clinton's Mideast negotiator. He has a piece in Foreign Policy called Humpty Dumpty Palestine, pointing out that Palestine is divided and decentralized and dysfunctional. And you mentioned earlier that criticism coming from Palestinians themselves is that this is a power grab by Abbas, since his rivals in Gaza, Hamas, don't seem to be a part of the deal. So what about the idea of a Palestinian state when the Palestinians are so divided?
This is what makes it all so much more ridiculous. The United States insisted that the Khmer Rouge government that had been driven out of Cambodia and lived in a few jungle camps on the Thai border be continued for many years to be recognized as the legitimate government of Cambodia in the U.S. We have recognized the Transitional Revolutionary Council, Transitional National Council in Libya as a legitimate government, when huge swathes of territory are still under the hands of Gaddafi. And I think you alluded earlier, is that when Israel was accepted into the United Nations, it did not have accepted fronting. In fact, it still doesn't. There was an armistice line, which it promised to respect, but the only sort of international legal frontiers as established were of the partition resolution before, well, in which case most of Galilee would be joining the West Bank in the Arab state. the Palestinians have, in a rare concession to reality, have actually ducked on that one. But, you know, all of this, almost every argument that has been thrown up against the Palestinian state flies directly in the face of previous U.S. policy when it was expedient. We are now calling for the recognition of Kosovo, and I accept that. But the Kosovo authorities in Pristina have only a tenuous hold on the territory north of Mitrovica. And you know, there is strong opposition there. So, you know, we're calling for... There is no consistency here. And, of course, there is only one reason, is that this, I think, much overrated fear of the power of the Israel lobby.
So, in terms of tactics on the part of the Palestinians, you hear one day that they're going to go to the Security Council and the next day that they're going to go to the General Assembly. Obviously, if they go to the General Assembly, they would get a majority vote, and that would be embarrassing to the U.S. when it eventually came to the veto. What's your understanding of their tactics?
Well, Nabil Sharpe, who's been a long-standing sort of PLO spokesperson, gave a press conference today, and each time there are more details, because obviously they're keeping their negotiating room wide open. They haven't committed themselves, and what he's indicating is that they won't go to the General Assembly and the Security Council simultaneously. They'll go to the, they'll put the application in the Security Council, which will then refer it to a special committee to look at. So this is going to keep the threat of a self-inflicted veto hovering over the Obama administration for many weeks to come. And following that is the threat that if you do veto it, then this then becomes an issue that is that under, once again, an American resolution introduced to combat Soviet vetoes during the Korean War, the Uniting for Peace resolution. They will ask for a reconvening of a special General Assembly to consider their request for an enhanced status. And, you know, in the 90s, the Palestinian mission had a very clear strategy of reinforcing international law and their position. So the Palestine mission to the UN can already speak, can already attend meetings. It doesn't have to be specially invited. It has all of the prerogatives of the state except the vote. And so, you know, this is, they're adding to this. And the key part, which I think really frightens some Israelis, at least in a irrational way, is the idea that if Palestine is accepted as a state by the General Assembly, then that will then give the go-ahead for the parties to the International Convention, the International Criminal Court, to accept a Palestinian signature. The significance there is that if Palestine is accepted as a state and its 1967 boundaries, the West Bank and Gaza, are accepted, then that means that crimes committed in that territory can be referred to the International Criminal Court. And, of course, there is one group of people who, by world repute, have been committing crimes in the occupied territories. So that is something that is a sort of potent scaring factor for the Israelis, and justifiably so, since they are committing crimes, and already under universal jurisdiction, a lot of Israeli military and civil leaders have to check with their lawyers and their travel agents simultaneously when they go anywhere.
But what about the fact that you've got the West Bank, whose leadership are pushing statehood, and you've got Hamas, which is in Gaza, a separate entity almost. The Egyptians try to stitch them back together again, but they're not even joined territorially. So what's this statehood declaration going to do for real unity within the Palestinians?
Well, it's not going to do that much unless it provides some wiggle room. But I think one of the points is, ever since Clinton, the U.S. has said that these issues have to be solved by bilateral negotiation between Israel and the Palestinians, including statehood. And this is inherently unfair. It's like putting a toddler and a sumo wrestler in an arena and saying, okay, the sumo wrestler stole your toy, now get it back off it. You know, there is international law here, and that's been implicitly accepted by Obama when he said that the settlement should be based on the 67 boundaries. You know, we're not talking about an open forum here. We're talking about something where rules are clearly written. Now, if it's accepted by everybody that the Palestinians have a claim to all of the a legitimate claim to all of those territories, then it obviously strengthens their hand. Even if it came to negotiating about land swaps, they're not going to say, "Oh yes, you can take away our biggest aquifers and our most fertile land and give us a chunk of the Negev desert in return." You know, it does strengthen their hand legally, and that's what they want here. If they're accepted as a state, it strengthens their hand in negotiations immeasurably, because it's not a case of begging for favors from Israel. They're two sovereign states discussing matters of contention. So in the end, that's one of the rational purposes behind the otherwise inexplicable insistence of Abbas on this move at the moment.
Well, just to change subjects, because obviously there are other things going on at the United Nations, Ian Williams, veteran journalist, has covered the UN for some time. Tell me what's going on with Ahmadinejad is coming over. Of course, he usually gets a lot of press, says outrageous things. I'm sure he says them deliberately to shore up his base at home. He got kind of insulted by the supreme leader on the eve of his departure, where he promised the release of these American hikers held hostage there and wasn't able to deliver. So what do you expect in terms of Ahmadinejad or any other fireworks in the coming weeks?
Well, it's an interesting contrast is the British Conservative government, or the coalition government, the British foreign minister met the Iranian foreign minister today and discussed mutual issues. And, you know, that's... The difference is that, you know, the Europeans can actually go and talk to the Iranians and tell them what they think, whereas because of all of these domestic prohibitions, U.S. diplomats are reduced to shouting across the oceans at people and not having any direct negotiations. And incidentally, the British foreign minister took them to task for hanging a 17-year-old, for example. So it wasn't a case of pandering and sweetness and light. That there were serious issues to be broached there.
Well, the Iranians have just arrested six people accusing them of working for the BBC, which apparently is a capital offence.
God help us all, yes. I've done work for the BBC myself. And, one of the points about Iran is that it's not a unitary state. It's not a dictatorship. There's lots of different power centres in there. And I think I've just seen a news report that the hitchhikers have actually been released. So in terms of a power struggle, if that were the case, then Ahmadinejad has sort of got the upper hand against the supreme leader. It's always difficult to tell on these things. But it is a lot more complex than you will get from the view you get from outside. I'm speaking to somebody who has no brief for religious... For theocracies of any kind, it's more attached to reality than image when it comes to these issues.
So, just in closing, then you don't expect anything else to be on the agenda, but the Palestinian issue.
This is one of the problems: is this issue, and it's good for the Palestinians that they've done this. They managed to embarrass and get more negotiating with a room out of Clinton and Co. Ban Ki-moon's speech was very eloquent, and I think that Ban Ki-moon has been consistently misunderestimated. He is far more outspoken than his predecessors. His delivery mightn't be as rhetorical, it's not quite up to Martin Luther King standards, but he is pushing hard for measures to combat poverty, he's pushing for measures against climate change. All of these issues, he's pushing hard on, and his speech was overshadowed by Obama and the whole Middle East brouhaha. And, incidentally, Ban Ki-moon's position on the Middle East has changed considerably since he took office and he began to be exposed from the reality. Once again, he's far more outspoken about what Israel has to do than his predecessors ever were. He does not get credit for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you for joining us, Ian Williams. Thank you.
We should speak more often. It's been a while.
It has been a while, and I thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Ian Williams, who's a veteran journalist, covered the UN for some time. He writes also for, he's a senior analyst on foreign policy in Focus and writes for Salon and Alternet. His blog is Deadline Pundit. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about progressive discontent with Obama. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Lux, who's the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies, where he's launched a number of important projects, including American Family Voices, an issue advocacy group, and the Progressive Donor Network. He currently serves on the boards of the ARCA Foundation, Americans United for Change, and the Center for Progressive Leadership. He was a co-founder of Ballot Initiative Strategy Center, Progressive Majority, and Women's Voices, Women's Vote, and played a role in helping launch the Center for American Progress and Air America. Mike was also Senior Vice President for Political Action at People for the American Way and served as a special assistant to President Clinton for public liaison in the White House. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lux.
Thanks, Ian. It's nice to be on.
And your credentials make it clear that you are progressive. So let's talk about President Obama and the progressives. At the moment, things aren't looking too good, although some people think that the recent speech by the president to the Congress and his subsequent speeches on the stump have made people feel a little bit better in terms of those that have been disappointed and disillusioned. But how is it facing up for the 2012 elections? Do you think that there will be a substantial defection of the progressive vote?
Well, I think it has been a rocky relationship, and there's no doubt about that. And I don't think the enthusiasm level about Obama is as high as certainly I would want it to be if I were managing the president's campaign among progressive activists or for that matter voters. One thing I think you have to look at as well, in addition to sort of the general feelings of political activists, disappointments on different issues and on some of the compromises that have made, but just look going into the Democratic base groups and how they've done in the economy during Obama's term. It's blacks, it's Hispanics, it's women, especially single women, it's young people who were Obama's base in 2008, who are traditionally the Democrats' base in general in recent elections, and who have gotten hit very, very hard by this economy. And I think, I go back to, I was knocking on doors in the 2010 election, and I was having people say to me, look, I don't even have time to think about politics. I've got to find a job. Or people saying, I don't have time to vote because I've got three jobs that I'm running in between to work that day. I think when people are discouraged and hard-pressed economically, they're not as likely to turn out to vote. And so you have to factor that in as well. And the combination of having disappointed a lot of activists on a lot of key issues
and the economy being so bad for Democratic base groups, I think, is a dangerous combination. Now, having said all that, let me you know, close the answer to that question with this. I do think that the president, in his two recent speeches, has begun the rehabilitation process with progressives, and I hope it continues. We won most of the fights, as to what Obama would do. Progressive organizations and bloggers and activists have been pushing him to fight hard for increasing taxes on millionaires and billionaires. We've been pushing for him not to cut Social Security. We've been pushing for him not to raise the eligibility age for Medicare. We've been pushing for him to have a major aggressive jobs program that he's promoting in Congress. So we've been winning a lot of battles lately in terms of what the president has been pushing in his policies, and I think that will help him politically with his base.
Mike Glaxo, Ralph Nader has just sent out an email blast calling for a progressive candidate to run in the Democratic primaries and challenge the president, and other progressive groups are organizing petitions along those lines. What do you think are the chances of a challenge, a primary challenge to the president? And of course, the last time a Democratic president, incumbent Democratic president, had a primary challenge was Jimmy Carter, who was challenged in the primary by Teddy Kennedy, who certainly damaged his Carter's re-election chances. And then, of course, in the general, he was challenged. There was a third-party candidate, Anderson, who was also a Republican, who also siphoned off a lot of progressive votes.
Yeah. I think the chances of having any, what I would call a serious candidate run against him in the Democratic primary, run against Obama in the Democratic primary, is virtually none. I think it's too late. I think that if that was going to happen, it should have been geared up, in the spring of this year or even early summer. And I think, if someone had emerged at that point and been willing to go to the barricades and and challenge the president. Especially as he was cutting these debt ceiling deals and other kinds of things that progressives didn't like, I think they might have gotten a wind in their sails and been able to mount a serious challenge. I mean, we're now talking it's late September right now. Not even a glimmer of a candidate has emerged, and the president's just, taken several major steps toward the progressive positions on the biggest issues of the day, at least some of the biggest issues, not all, but some of them. So I think it's very unlikely that you're going to see a progressive challenger at this point. I just don't see a scenario by which that happens. I mean, certainly it might happen if, somebody like Ralph Nader did it, but I don't think anybody would think of Ralph Nader as, as a particularly serious threat, to the president's renomination. And, Ralph, of course, hasn't supported Democrats for a long time. So I don't think he could mount much of a campaign. And I just don't see anybody else out there who's even interested, who's talking about it, who's got a glimmer of a chance on it. So I don't see it happening. Speculation or positioning. Obama has specifically gone out of his way to distance himself from progressive issues and the progressive wing of the party, and he's made it very clear that he disagrees with progressives on a lot of these issues. So I think that to be dismissive of that is absolutely the wrong way, certainly for Obama's people to be thinking.
Sure.
I think, though, that the president's recent moves toward the progressive pole. And I think what's happened is the progressives, by organizing, by their strong statements, have created a left flank for the president and a sort of magnetic pole, and that he started to draw them toward that pole. And I think that's a really good thing. And I think it's a really good thing that progressives did that. I think it's a really good thing that Obama responded to it. And I know for myself, I am much happier with Obama than I was 3 weeks ago when he was talking about raising the Medicare eligibility age and cutting Social Security when we weren't sure he was even going to have a major jobs program. But now he's moving in that direction. And so I think that's the way you repair the bridge to progressives, not by doing the Jonathan Alter thing of where people should just stop whining.
So Mike Lux, there is, of course, this new book by Ron Suskin, who I'll be talking to fairly soon. It's getting a lot of coverage, apparently, it doesn't sound helpful at all to the president to be portrayed as somebody that's not up to the job. That's the very thing that Mitt Romney is going to try and run with if he gets the nomination. And one of the revelations in this book by Ron Suskin is that Timothy Geithner and Summers basically ignored the president, were almost insubordinate, which gives you the impression that he's not in charge. Now, do you think, without getting into the book, because I haven't read it and I haven't interviewed him yet, do you think that in any way the president could, say to the progressives who somehow think that he didn't deliver, could he say, look, you know, being president of the United States doesn't mean you can wave a magic wand and get things done. I mean, there are some very powerful interests in this country that one has to navigate around and negotiate with. This is just the reality, and not the least of which, of course, is Wall Street. Would that be helpful?
Oh, I think it would be. I do think it would be very helpful. A friend of mine, a guy by the name of Bob Creamer, wrote a great blog post after the 2010 election that he entitled "The Empire Struck Back," and his basic point was, you know, you look at the amount of money that the big banks, the big oil companies, the major insurers, and other corporate special interests who didn't like the progressive agenda or the Obama agenda put into the 2010 elections and put into lobbying against, you know, many things that Democrats were trying to get done. I mean, it was billions of dollars. When you add up the campaign contributions, the lobbying dollars, the PR dollars, the 527 spending, all of these things, it was billions of dollars. And they were able to frame the election that government was the end-all, be-all problem. And if you just turned it over to those of us smart guys in the private sector, we'll create jobs and solve all the problems. I think Obama can take to the American people the case that these wealthy and powerful special interests are getting in the way of what's good for this country, and I'm fighting them. And the reason I haven't always been successful is that they are powerful guys. They are entrenched interests. But I'm going to fight them on your behalf. Join with me.
Well, that's the key, isn't it, surely, Mike?
That kind of message, I think, appeals to progressives and to working-class swing voters. And just one comment along those lines. It's very clear to me that on most of these economic issues, the progressive movement and swing voters are very, very much in alignment on Social Security, on Medicare, on Medicaid, on taxes on the wealthy, a whole range of issues. We in the progressive movement and those among swing voters are very much in alignment, and that's something that I think is important for Obama as well as other folks to understand.
Well, what I was going to add to that, Mike Lux, is that it would seem to me that if the president were to say, look, you know, there's this powerful special interest forces in this country, they're arrayed against me, they have blocked my agenda, but the way to take this country back is to join me in this battle and have my back. Doesn't it come down to the fact that what's really happened with Citizens United and the Kochs and all of this, the incipient American oligarchy, is that you've got essentially a situation now where money has transcended votes and people. And the only way to reverse that equation is for more and more people to show up.
That's exactly right, and I completely agree with you. It'd be a very powerful message on Obama's part. A pollster who is a friend of mine, I worked with him in the Clinton years, but he's got a very popular streak. His name is Stan Greenberg, and Stan has done a New York Times op-ed talking about how the way Democrats win the faith of the voters is by being willing and being aggressive about taking on these big special interests that control Washington, and being the party of reform, and being willing to take on these big money guys that are moving these hundreds of millions of dollars through the system to try to buy elections and try to buy the people who are elected. And I do think that's a very powerful message and a very important message.
Well, Mike Lux, I thank you for joining us here.
It's been a pleasure. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. And tell Susskind when you interview him that I've started on the book and I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
Okay, well, again, I've been speaking with Michael Lux, who's the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He was formerly Senior Vice President for Political Action at People for the American Way and served as a special assistant to President Clinton for public liaison in the White House. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how red states that are dominated by the religious right, the people that Perry is appealing to, in fact have a lower standard of living, if you will, in many respects, than people in the blue states.
Conspiracy-minded protesters of corporate greed. We who have nothing and most likely will till we all end up locked up in jail by conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American man. Diamonds and dogs, boys and
theologians, they don't know nothing about my soul.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Schwartz, who is a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research. He's also the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. He has an article in the science journal Explore, The Rise of American Theocracy, Implications for Science and Healthcare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Schwartz.
Hello, Ian.
And obviously with the ascendance of Rick Perry as the leading Republican candidate for president, and of course he started out his campaign at a religious revival meeting in Houston, he apparently is, although President Clinton has referred to him as a rascal, other sources have told me that he actually believes in the rigid Christian right religious dogma that he espouses. So is that what's triggered your concern about the rise of American theocracy?
Well, I think that it is time, given that what I would actually call premillennial dispensationalist Darbyism, which is really what that theology is, that kind of rigid end times premillennial view of the world, since that is arising as a political force in the country, I think we ought to take a look at what are the effects of these kinds of religious policies. I mean, this is not just an ideological issue. These questions are susceptible to scientific analysis based on, you know, hard data. And I think if you take a look at what the philosophies of someone like Rick Perry represent for the country, not based on what he's saying, but the outcomes of what happens when people like him come to power, it's pretty scary.
So do you think that nobody's put forth any criticism at this point, but presumably if he becomes a nominee, there'll be plenty of time for that, and one would think that his Republican opponents, at least Huntsman, I think is about the only one that's not a Christian evangelical, that this country, its hegemony around the world, its rise as a global superpower, had much to do with science and invention, not to mention the atomic bomb, which, of course, maybe is not the best example, but it's a very real one.
Well, the last 500 years has seen the careful accretion of information about the world and how it works, and all of that was attained through scientific methods. And I think that really, science really is, in many ways, the intellectual crown jewel of human history. So to begin to take it apart on the basis of theology and ideology in a kind of fact-free world strikes me as rather perverse. But I'm arguing something much more concrete than that. I'm saying if you look at the social outcomes that occur in states where white evangelical Protestants are in the ascendancy, this kind of rigid, dogmatic Christianity, you see, for instance, that there are far more divorces in those states where this is the dominant political worldview than in more liberal areas like the West Coast. I mean, I understand that Christians talk about family and marriage and all that, but the reality is that divorce is far more prevalent, and so is spousal abuse. That is, and particularly physical spousal abuse. That's one, you know, beating up on your wife because you don't like what she's doing. Or you could look at obesity. I mean, researchers at Northwestern University found that young adults who frequently attend religious activities are far more likely to become obese than those who don't. Or you look at violence. If you look at the correlation between the most religious states and the most violent states, you see that Louisiana, Tennessee, Alabama, Texas, Arkansas, these states which are both the most religious are also the most violent. And what my argument is, if these people are going to advance this as a political philosophy as opposed to just a religious view, that they ought to be held to the standards of good scientific analysis as to whether these kinds of programs actually produce the kind of society that we, most Americans, say they want.
So given the statistics, particularly the economic ones, since we're going into a recession and perhaps even a depression, obviously when times are tough, people turn towards deities for some comfort. So I'm wondering here whether the religious right will prosper from the recession, or conversely, since so much of the religious right is about the televangelists shaking down people for money, will some of these televangelists simply not do that well because of the recession?
We're going to find out. My guess is that donations of all kinds we know to be down. I mean, philanthropies in general are experiencing decreased contributions. And I suppose that, although I don't know because we don't have the data yet, and again, I mean, I stress this needs to be evaluated on a fact basis, not a polemic or ideological basis. But what we can say is that in those states where these political philosophies are the dominant view that those states are not doing well economically for their citizens, that people are making less money, there's more obesity, there's more divorce, there's more spousal abuse, all of these kinds of social outcomes. There is lower educational attainment at a time when India and China are generating PhDs and engineers at an astonishing rate. If you look at American educational systems, particularly, again, in these states where autocratic religious views dominate, they're doing worse. So if we're going into the 20th century with an ill-educated, and it, you can hardly be anything but, I mean, there is a concerted effort in the United States amongst the religious right to pass laws which support creationism. And according to the Pew Research Group, 55% of Americans now believe the world was created within the last 6,000 years. Well, if you believe the world was created in the last 6,000 years, you have to throw out virtually the entirety of science. I mean, anthropology gone, paleontology gone, geology gone, physics gone, chemistry gone. I mean, you have to believe, for instance, that the speed of light is wrong. Because if the world was created 6,000 years ago, how is it we're getting light from stars that are hundreds of thousands of light years away? I mean, you just can't reconcile those two points. So if we have a person like Rick Perry who passionately believes the world was created 6,000 years ago, how in the world is a person like that going to deal with the challenging scientific issues which face any developed nation in the 21st century?
So, Stephen Schwartz, in your article in the Science Journal, Explore the Rise of American Theocracy, Implications for Science and Healthcare, you make the distinction between religion and spirituality, and you say it's time that we look at religion not through the lens of divinity, but through the lens of its humanity. Isn't that really the great paradox of the religious right, that they in many ways exhibit a hostility towards humanity? They're very hostile towards their fellow human beings who are homosexual. They're very much in favor of capital punishment, as we've witnessed just in Georgia. At least in terms of the Catholics, in terms of their right to life philosophy, they both oppose abortion and capital punishment. But the Christian evangelicals, particularly in the red states, simply don't have that religious consistency, at least that theological consistency.
That's correct. We have clearly going on as a result of this right-wing theocratic impulse that these forces that are in play in our country, we have a war on women. You can look at the Planned Parenthood attack, which hung up the entire budget for a while, not just as an argument about abortion. No, it's really much more about contraception, about women's right to have equal treatment, to have equality. There's a whole movement that's going on within the Christian evangelical movement that's even more conservative, that teach women that, no, that they shouldn't even go to college because that just turns their minds and makes them doubt their role as homemakers. I mean, this all comes out of the homeschooling movement, because if you homeschool kids, and you do so for these conservative religious purposes, well, then you only teach them things which support the creationist worldview, for instance. Patrick Henry University was created explicitly in order to create a cadre of Christian fundamentalists who would take over the government. And during the Bush administration, there were more interns from Patrick Henry University than any other school in the country. I mean, this is a consistent, thought-out philosophy of politics and theology whose purpose is to try to get control of the United States. And for purposes of their own special interests, a number of very rich people are funding this. Not that they're religious zealots themselves, but these people provide useful foot soldiers to advance their purposes. And it's time that we really took a look at what comes out of a society which follows these conservative right-wing philosophies. You know, Sinclair Lewis said, if fascism ever comes to America, it will come brandishing the cross and wrapped in the flag. And I think that pretty well sums up the whole thing.
So, Stephen Swartz, I'm just trying to get a sense of the theology here, of why it is such an angry and punitive kind of theology. There's no reflection of the Gospel according to St. Matthew, the Beatitudes. There's no sense that the prophet Jesus, who as an historical figure clearly had compassion for the poor and for the downtrodden, and if anything, if he had politics, he would certainly have been way on the left, not on the right. I'm reminded of the revolutionary inspiration of Thomas Paine, who said, "A cruel God makes a cruel man." What explains the punitive, angry nature of evangelicalism in this country as opposed to a more Christian interpretation of the gospel?
Well, I think it stems from a sense of persecution. It feeds on a reiteration of victimhood. You get a sense that you're being persecuted, which causes people to band together. I think it arises because it gives a promise of exclusivity. It is exclusionist in its fundamentals. That is, only the people who believe as you believe can be saved, and therefore everybody else is condemned. I think it feeds on the very human emotion of wanting to get back and poke your finger in the eye of people who are better off or have something more than you have, so that it plays on base human emotions. And it isn't really Christian. That's the point. It is premillennial dispensationalist Darbyism. And now it's morphing not just into the end times, but into this new form that's called dominionism, which is being espoused by a number of the Republican political candidates. And that's a real form of American imperialism that I think holds quite unfortunate implications for the long-range position and well-being of the United States. And I think it is time for us to take a look at these people and see what their policies produce. And we can measure this, just like we can measure the effects of exercise or the effects of meditation or the effects of healthy eating or anything else, education. This is susceptible to objective measurement. And before we plunge ourselves down the rat hole of religious fundamentalism and electing politicians that espouse this view, I think we would be very well advised to take a look at what the outcomes are when you let these people into power.
But just in closing, Stephen Swartz, you mentioned the lack of education being a common factor here amongst the other things that you listed. Why is it then that this theology of dominionism is gaining political traction? There's a professor at Princeton who is one of the leading proponents of it. What is the sort of intellectual dressing of this kind of...
We're believers and we're better than the other guys.
But how do they make an intellectual argument that the United States should become a theocracy?
Well, you have to start, they begin with the idea, this revisionist history, which is that the founders really intended the country to be a Christian country. Now, the problem with that is that although there is ample evidence that all of the major founders, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, Madison, were deists, not Christians, in the sense that these people mean it. They'd have been appalled by this. You got to remember, it doesn't get talked about very much in the conservative circles, but all of the founders had either direct experience or family history, quite recent. I mean, you know, the Tudor history and the great struggle between Catholics and Protestants was one of the reasons a number of those families came to the United, or then the, what is now the United States, then the colonial world, because they were trying to get away from the struggle of the state controlling religion. In addition to that, in 1797, in the Treaty of Tripoli, in Article 11, a treaty which was published in virtually every newspaper in the United States, which was read on the Senate floor and affirmed twice and signed by John Adams, it says explicitly, the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. Now, that's about as explicit a statement as you could get. And as I say, it was published in all the newspapers and read on the Senate floor. It's part of the proceedings. So you have to go back to that. The initial presumption in the revisionist history is that it's just a misreading, that what the founders really meant was we should be a Christian country. That's completely bogus. That's the start. Then you begin with American exceptionalism. We're better than everybody else. Our view is better than everybody else. This kind of American exceptionalist view, which again is a fact-free view, because if you look at our justice system, we don't rank very high. If you look at our healthcare system, we're either 26th or 31st in the world. If you look at infant mortality or maternal mortality, we don't rank very high. If you look at our educational achievements, we don't rank very high. America would be well advised as it goes into this century to pull back into itself and recommit itself to becoming truly an exceptional country, because right now we're riding mostly on reputation.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Stephen Schwartz.
Glad to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who is a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research. He's also the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. He has an article in the science journal Explore, The Rise of American Theocracy, Implications for Science and Healthcare. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.